You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, September 11th, 2013, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jane Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Here we go again, everyone. How's everybody doing tonight?
Quite good. How are you,
Evan? Very well. Thank you.
It is September 11th, 12th anniversary.
I almost forgot, but then I saw a bumper sticker.
You know what? I have not heard anyone joke around about September 11th yet.
What?
It has happened, yeah.
Really?
I really haven't.
Seth MacFarlane pokes fun at it now.
Yeah, I think it's reached the point where, I mean, like, day after people were joking about it.
I just haven't heard anything.
Probably not in the best taste, I would say.
Yeah, but today I've seen mostly just reports of very respectful memorial services. I mean, there were almost 3,000 people killed during the attacks. Obviously, it's only been 12 years, so still a lot of family members and loved ones remembering them. Bob, Jay, and I were recently at the 9/11 memorial. Evan, Rebecca, have you guys been there?
I have. It's
I haven't driven by it, but I didn't. Wasn't able to stop and
it's beautiful.
You know, give it the time yet. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting.
I actually like the design of the new tower. I don't know if you guys know the what the intent was there, but it was supposed to be if you could imagine the two World Trade Center towers, and if you kind of fuse them together and then offset it a little bit, I think that's kind of like, you know, the shape they were going for. If you're wondered why it's that shape.
Is that fact, Bob?
I think so. I remember reading that a while ago. I think that's what they were going for.
Because
it was interesting.
To
me, though, the most impressive thing, though, were those two square-shaped waterfalls in the footprint of each tower. I mean, I thought that was just an inspired idea. It's just so gorgeous. And then with all the names of everybody, you know, wrapped around the perimeter. It's really quite something to see.
It's unfortunate we know of a few of those names. I know of a few personally. I know you guys have a connection also to at least one person who perished that day.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we live close to New York City, so we're an hour and a half to 2 hours north, and you know, we just know a lot of people that work there, go back and forth, and one of the people that we know was a firefighter.
So I was looking around just to see if the conspiracy theorists were acting up today. Didn't find much, although I did come across a story I hadn't read before. Have you guys read the story of Charlie Veach?
No,
not familiar.
He was a big-time conspiracy theorist, proponent of the standard 9/11 conspiracy theories. And, you know, young guy, he got tapped to do the Conspiracy Roadshow. You guys familiar with that show out of the UK?
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so he was the conspiracy theorist, and the director of the show tried to convince him that his conspiracy theories were incorrect and the standard story of what happened, especially with the Twin Towers, like how they fell, that story had the evidence behind it. And he had him speak to a lot of experts, like a demolitions expert, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And
really?
Initially, Veach held his ground, but eventually he succumbed and he admitted that there wasn't a conspiracy. He was convinced by the evidence.
Wow.
I don't believe you. You're just making that up.
No, that's awesome, Steve.
That doesn't happen. Mm. That doesn't happen.
Well, it happened. He did it. And wow. then he made a video. So he had a conspiracy YouTube channel, and then he filmed it. He filmed himself saying, "I no longer believe in the 9/11 conspiracy. I don't think it was
amazing.
An inside job. The evidence just all points." And he makes a very skeptical sounding comments about how, you know, you eventually have to follow the evidence. And now he like really has come out against the conspiracy subculture about how evil it is, paranoid, hateful, anti-Semitic. You know, he's been now under severe death threats. You know, somebody sent around an email to 15,000 people accusing him of pedophilia, including like all of his family and personal friends.
Whoa.
Yeah, really attacked.
They're so classy, those guys, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's
very
par
interesting
for the course.
Story.
For unfortunately, we see that all the time. It's the same with the Scientologists or this other hardcore conspiracy theories.
It's too bad. There's a lot of celebrities, a lot of big names that lend their comments and their outright opinions in those directions.
Right.
It's really hard to read because some of these people I actually enjoy watching them as artists or performers, and I just absolutely can't stand their lack of critical thinking on the entire 9/11 conspiracy theories.
I feel like it's been losing a foothold, though. Like, I never see the mainstream media reporting on 9/11 truthers anymore. Do you guys? I mean, the biggest thing I can think of in the past 2 years was the
Charlie Sheen's meltdown.
No, like a DC Comics put out. We talked about it on the show. I only
that 9/11 comic.
Yeah, about the time traveler guy who went back in time to prevent 9/11 and found out that was a government plot or whatever.
Right.
That's really all I can think of.
I agree. I mean, it's hard. It's always a subjective perception, but I do. It does seem that they are on the fringe.
Yeah.
And
where they belong, and they'll never go away.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't think they have much of a grip on popular culture. But I don't know what and I probably should look it up, like what the latest polls say about how many Americans believe 9/11 was an inside job.
Are you guys aware of the movie coming up to be released in 2015 called September Morn?
No.
So it's supposedly, because they're just have apparently started production, starring Charlie Sheen and Woody Harrelson, who are two of the more outspoken celebrities about 9/11 being an inside job. They are taking part in this, and although it is a fictional movie, they're still taking it in the context of that, this still, might actually be the truth. The IMDb just has one sentence about it. It says, in the tradition of the award-winning 12 Angry Men, a historical showcase of characters meet to forever change the illusions and deceptions of America's second Pearl Harbor. So apparently it's going to have a conspiracy sort of bend to it, and that's an unfortunate sign for the future, I think, that they're going to be
fortunately,
a lot of,
Charlie Sheen and Woody Harrelson don't have careers anymore. So, this is going to be, if this actually gets made, it's going to be a direct-to-YouTube disaster. That's my prediction.
God. Yeah, I could see it going that way.
So the most recent public opinion poll that I could find is a March 2010 poll conducted by the Angus Reid Public Opinion Organization. And they have the figure at only 15% saying that the World Trade Center was brought down by a controlled demolition. And only 6 to 15% of respondents found credibility in claims that the United Airlines Flight 93 was shot down.
That is a disturbingly large number, though, 15%.
But it's down from 40%. But it depends on, depends on exactly how you ask the questions. Yeah. It's hard to compare them.
Yeah, if it's anything like, did Bush have involvement, then, those are the ones that come out and they have this huge percentage. And it's like, that could be read in a number of different ways.
Yeah. Right. And, as Rebecca, you could see whatever you want in numbers, right?
Good point. For instance, it might be nice to think that, this case with the 9/11 truther is something that could be replicated easily. Like, you give him the facts and he examines them from a scientific mindset and then he changes his mind to fit the facts. However, a new study that just came out suggests that politically hot topics like 9/11 conspiracy theorists or global warming or other topics like that might be hard to convince people to go against their politics using just facts, just science or even mathematics. This study was, just came out. It's actually available online in full, which is nice, for those of you who have an interest in reading it. It's part of the Cultural Cognition Project. You can find the link on the notes page, if you want to go check it out. The title of the paper is Motivated Numeracy and Enlightened Self-Government. It's by a few researchers. The most notable that you've probably heard of would be Dan Kahan, who is fairly prominent. He's written a couple of really interesting science books about psychology. And what they did was they found that people can actually people who are good at math suddenly get not so great at math when dealing with a hot button issue. So the way they found this out was to take actually an impressively large number of subjects. Over 1,000 participants were involved. They were asked their political views and divvied up liberals and conservatives in the final results. So 1,000 participants were asked their political views, and then they took tests to determine their numeracy, which just means their ability to use math to solve word problems, sort of thing. And then they were given a fake scientific study and asked to evaluate it. And for half of the participants, they were given a study about a skin cream for treating rashes. And the other half were given a study that was identical, except for instead of being about a skin cream, it was about about concealed carry laws. Which, you know, when I first read that, I'm like, how do you even create two identical studies about two wildly different topics? But they managed to do it. Actually quite clever. What they did was, so for the skin cream people, they described a test that this cream had undergone on people's rashes. They said that half the patients in this study got the skin cream, the other half did not get the skin cream. Here's how many people got the skin cream and their rash got better. Here's how many people got the skin cream and their rash got worse. Here's how many people did not get the skin cream and their rash got better. Here's how many did not get the skin cream and their rash got worse. And then they were asked, what result does the study support? People who used the skin cream were more likely to get better than those who didn't, or people who used the skin cream were more likely to get worse than those who didn't. And the identical problem with the concealed carry laws described cities that outlawed concealed carry of firearms and broke it down into the same kind of rubric. So here's how many cities outlawed concealed handguns and crime got better. Here's how many outlawed it and crime got worse. Here's how many cities did not outlaw it and crime got better. Here's how many did not outlaw it and crime got worse. And then they were asked, which result does the study support? So hopefully you can imagine those two things. And as you can see, if you are not really very literate in mathematics, it's kind of a tricky question. You might be tempted to just look at the numbers of in the case of the skin cream, you might be tempted to just say, well, 223 people used the skin cream and the rash got better, and 107 did not use the skin cream and the rash didn't get better, so the cream is better. But, you know, if you actually wanted to figure this out, you would find out what percentage of people got better, what percentage of people got worse, and you would compare those percentages to find out whether or not it's actually worthwhile to use the skin cream.
So what's interesting, Rebecca, is that, you know, what they were looking at was not just a superficial reading of the numbers, but a specific heuristic that people will tend to default to, where they just compare either – there's two heuristics that people will use naively. One is they'll just compare the number that got better with and with versus without, or they'll compare the number that got better with the treatment versus did not get better. But as you said, neither of those analyses are – logically valid. You have to actually compare the ratio, the percentage of both. So what they were really looking at are people who defaulted to the simplistic and inaccurate heuristics versus took the time to do a more thorough analysis of the numbers, which is, it was still surprising to me just across the board how few people did the simple math to figure out what the ratios were.
Yeah, it was something like only, for the skin cream problem, I think it was something like only 40% of people actually were able to do that math and figure it out. But that's not the purpose of the study.
Right.
What they found, you know, the maybe obvious results that they got were that the people who they had determined were more numerate were able to use the more complex math in order to come to the correct decision. People who were less numerate tended to go with the more simplistic heuristic. However, the results became really interesting when they looked at what happened with the gun example, the concealed carry example. And so if you were to look at a chart of how well people did on the skin cream, it would be like a pretty obvious straight line. Like the more the more numerate you are, the better you do on this question. Straight line going up. But when it comes to the politicized gun control question, what they found was that the people who were more numerate actually did much better on the test if the result conformed to their political beliefs, and much worse if the result did not conform to their political beliefs. So for each test, they switched it up. You know, for half the people taking the skin cream question, the skin cream worked. For half the people, it did not work. There wasn't a difference between those two groups, obviously. And for the gun control question, for half the questions, the fictional study showed that banning concealed carry worked. And for the other half, they found banning concealed carry did not work. And what they found was that Republicans tended to do much better on the test where concealed carry, banning concealed carry did not work, and much worse where banning concealed carry did work. And the same with Democrats. Democrats did the math along with their political beliefs. And the really surprising thing is that the results got even more polarized with the more numerate people. So the better you are at math and science and logical thinking, the worse you do with a fairly simple math problem that opposes your viewpoints, which is all in all a very depressing finding for those of us who would like to think that if only we can just give the facts of about global warming to the world, that then they'll be convinced. No. Or evolution or anything else. They tried to figure out, well, why, what's going on in their head? Like, are they doing the math right and then deciding that they must have gotten something wrong and then going back? Or are they starting from the point where they are pretty sure they know what's what, and they glance at the data and they decide in the end to not actually do the complex math? And the researchers think it's that latter point.
Yeah, that's what I think. I think that we, people use the simplistic heuristic. They just look at the number, the left column, and if it fits their bias, they're done. If it doesn't fit their bias, they go, wait a minute, I better take a closer look at this. But it also is, there's a couple other things I think that this data shows. It is interesting that the more numerate, the more mathematically competent people had a greater effect here. And it wasn't just that they more often got it right when it was in line with their beliefs. They got it more wrong when it was against their belief. It's like they were using their smarts to rationalize the opposite answer, you know, the answer that they wanted, the opposite from the truth. It's also interesting that it showed that the effect was pretty much identical for Republicans and Democrats. There wasn't a difference between the two ideological ends of the spectrum. So it seems to be a generic effect.
Does that indicate a certain hardwiring?
Well, I think the heuristics are hardwiring, and I think, you know, that people will tend to do that unless they spend the time to think critically, you know, make that mental effort.
It's very hard for the people to overcome that hardwiring that they have.
Yeah, you can overcome it, but if you're lazy, mm-hmm. you won't, and the laziness right. was motivated by being in line with their ideological beliefs.
Yeah, and remember that the Democrat-Republican breakdown, I think, is just an easy sort of simplistic way to judge this, but the same can be true of just any internalized belief you have. You know, like I think evolution would be a good one. You know, yeah. I think this goes pretty far in showing, like, if you are starting from the belief that, you know, the Bible is the inerrant word of God, then even when you're given straight facts, you're going to find a way to justify them to fit what you already believe, especially if you're very intelligent. And we've seen that. You know, we had like when we had McElroy. Don McElroy on. Yeah, he's not a dumb man. He's a smart man, and that actually makes him much more difficult to win over.
Because he was using his cleverness, his smarts, to rationalize his beliefs in a subtle, sophisticated way.
And do you think that makes you dig your heels in even farther?
Oh yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, you've spent more time and energy you know, backing up your position. So, yeah, I'd say so. Yeah. You have more invested.
I think where this phenomenon comes out dramatically is in the next item that we're going to talk about, which is this year, Arctic sea ice has increased by 60%. And this, of course, is leading to...
Global warming is a lie.
Yeah, a rash of people who don't accept the consensus on climate change saying global warming is not happening, and even saying that, oh, we're entering a cooling phase now. And this is, a perfect example of the motivated numeracy, because you've got people with different ideological backgrounds looking at the same set of data, the same graphs, the same numbers, and coming to opposite conclusions. In this case, they're not defaulting to heuristics. They're cherry picking. They're looking at the data, a limited set of data, rather than, which this is where it's similar to the previous item, rather than looking at all the data in a meaningful context. So, here's the skinny with this, the Arctic sea ice. Since we've been carefully measuring it, you know, since, you know, around 1980, the average amount of sea ice in the Arctic, circle has been pretty steadily decreasing and in fact accelerating in its, the rate at which it's decreasing. Of course, if you look year to year, like any climate data, you see these wild fluctuations. First of all, there's seasonal fluctuations, so you have to always compare the same date to the same date. How much ice was there on August 1st of 2012 versus August 1st, 2013? Because obviously the summer-winter differences are huge. But when you do that comparison year to year, controlling for the time of year, you get these wild fluctuations. But if you look at the data over 30 years, 40 years, there's a clear downward trend. There's also something that you see in the data, which is, again, a very basic statistical phenomenon called regression to the mean, which we've talked about on the show quite a few times. Whereas in any fluctuating system like this, any extreme data point is likely to be followed by a data point that is closer to the mean. It will tend to regress to the mean. That's just a purely mathematical statistical phenomenon. So what you see with the fluctuations of the ice, when you have a year where there's a lot of sea ice, where you get an upward peak, it's very likely that it's going to be followed by a downward trend. And whenever you get a year with a downward spike, it's going to regress to the mean upward the following year. So what those who are motivated to deny that global warming is occurring, what they do is every time the Arctic sea ice increases, they say it's quote unquote recovering, or that it's, you know, they emphasize or point out that, oh, look at that, the Arctic sea ice increased this year, global warming isn't happening, ignoring the long-term trend. So 2012, Arctic sea ice was hit its minimum since it has been recorded. This, the lowest amount of Arctic sea ice to ever be recorded was last year. So guess what? Regression to the mean. It was absolutely predictable that this year, you know, the fluctuation was going to go back towards the mean and we were going to see an increase, which is exactly what happened. To say that this says anything about the trend in sea ice is, again, it's mathematically illiterate. It's absurd. And it's in fact predicted by regression to the mean.
So what you're saying is global warming is a lie.
Yeah. So this is one line of evidence. Obviously Arctic sea ice isn't the whole story. You have to look at surface temperatures, global sea temperatures, all of the, you know, glaciers, you know, Antarctic ice, which is actually not decreasing. But if you look at everything, you know, there's a pretty strong consensus, 97% by some estimates, that there's more heat in the Earth system, you know, because more heat is being retained because of man-made emissions, carbon dioxide, et cetera. So, the decrease in Arctic sea ice is consistent with that, but, you know, the data is being distorted by cherry picking. And they're doing the same thing with the surface temperatures. You probably have heard the meme, which is very popular among global warming deniers, that there hasn't been any warming in the last 15, 16 years. Is, again, if you look at the last 100 years of surface temperatures, there are decades where the temperature's increasing and then decades where it's leveling off a little bit and then it increases again. So we're just in the period where the temperatures are still increasing, just not as fast as it has been. that they haven't decreased. You know, we're not seeing any reversal in the trend. And if you look at the, if you look at all the data over the last, you know, 50, 60, 70 years, there's still this fairly consistent line you can draw through the data that is steadily heading up. And this is just a local fluctuation, but they're saying global warming has stopped. Global warming has paused because they're looking only at this one little short, you know, segment of data. But of course, they've said that every time there were a short segment gives the appearance of a quote unquote pause in the long-term trend of warming. Again, it's just cherry picking a subset of the data. Also, surface temperatures are not the whole story of global warming. It's only one piece. You know, the heat, the extra heat that we're experiencing, exists in many places, not just in surface temperatures. And, there is evidence to suggest that, a lot of the extra heat in the last decade has actually gone into the deep oceans. So the Earth is still warming. It's just you have to look at all the temperature everywhere, not just surface temperatures. They also, around these issues, are exploiting debates among climatologists about the details of climate models and exactly where the heat goes and all, you know, the little details, as if that calls into question the bigger picture that we're warming and natural forcing does not explain it, which is identical to creationists exploiting debate about the details of who, what, when, you know, when and how evolution occurs with, as if it calls into question the basic fact that life evolved. Very interesting. But it could be very persuasive, you know, to even very intelligent people, because they're very, very good at rationalizing arguments that fit their ideology. Bob, we should have robots brains. Take over. We should make all our decisions for us, right?
Nice segue. Yeah, I'm going to try and refrain from invoking the typical imminent robot takeover meme. It's not going to be easy, so wish me luck. So, guys, this really fascinated the hell out of me. A new study has been released about financial markets and machine ecologies. The gist of this is that the hyper-efficient trading algorithms used in the global financial markets are causing these ultra-fast extreme events, like a stock market crash or a spike that lasts under a second. Now, this is actually, it's a new realm of market behavior that kind of exists outside of human behavior because it's too fast for us to deal with in real time. So check this out. This study is appearing in the September 11th issue of Nature Scientific Reports, and it's titled Abrupt Rise of New Machine Ecology Beyond Human Response Time. I didn't know this. Tell me if you guys knew this. Lately and occasionally, the computers the global financial markets rely on, they get kind of like a bit of a blue screen of death. Kind mm-hmm. of a glitch of sorts that freezes everything up temporarily. Now, these scientists, they wanted to know, you know, what exactly was happening with this? Why was this happening and why only relatively recently? So they examined the price stream, of many different stocks and exchanges. And most importantly, they did this with very, very high resolution. They tracked these purchases and sales millisecond by millisecond. And what they found was that there were more than 18,000 of these ultra-fast extreme events, a crash or a spike, for example, that lasted only on average less than a second and a half. So they're very disruptive, but they're very, very short, very brief. So they conclude that these are caused not by people or regulations or anything, but they're caused by the rise of mobs of ultra-fast robots. Now, they call them robots. I don't like that. They're computer algorithms. There's software that makes decisions to sell or buy stocks at extreme speed. So how do they know that it was algorithms though? I mean, there could potentially be different things that are causing this, I guess. Well, one reason is that this phenomenon did not arise until Skynet sent an algorithm into the past. Crap, I did it. Sorry. Another reason is that all this started.
Close.
Yeah, right. All of this started in 2006, actually, right after new legislation was enacted to make this high frequency trading very, very useful. So is that just a coincidence? I don't think so. Another reason is that these spikes are of such a magnitude compared to the average changes that happen, say, with stock prices. We're talking like 30 standard deviations, you know, up or down. And so basically, chance the fact that these could be chance events are essentially ruled out because they're just too damn big and too often. And then the other reason, of course, is that humans just can't operate at this millisecond time scale. It takes us a full second just to recognize that an action needs to be taken, you know, regardless of the circumstance. We just are not wired to operate that fast. So the scientists found that at these extreme events, as they dipped below the human threshold to monitor in real time, their occurrence increased dramatically. They really took off once they dropped that threshold where we could actually have some sort of input and influence on them. So it's interesting. They actually compare the financial market ecosystem to prey and predators. And these algorithms are often referred to as predatory. And they actually are, if you think about it, in that they're designed to spot a financial opportunity and pounce. I mean, that's what they do. They take advantage. So in this analogy, the predators attack their prey even before they are aware of their presence. They're just so incredibly fast. The fact that these algorithms are fast is because they're simple. They need to be as simple as possible in order to operate as fast as they do. And because of that, they've got a limited number of things that they could actually do. So they're a little bit constrained as to what they can actually perform. So consequently, many of these algorithms often do the same thing, which is why they call them mobs, because they act together. So it's these mobs of predatory algorithms. I just love that phrase. These mobs of predatory algorithms acting in concert that can cause these extreme events.
Wouldn't they be packs? To happen. Packs of predatory?
I've read both mobs and packs. I think mobs is actually more prevalent.
Murders.
So what do you guys think? What do you guys think of this? Do you think this is inherently bad?
Yeah, well, I mean, it sounds like the law of unintended consequences. It sounds to me, I'm not sure if this is exactly what's happening, that, as you say, there's the mob behavior where a bunch of algorithms are all doing the same thing. But is it also that they get stuck in a very rapid feedback, situation where you get these extreme results because, you know, their behavior, their algorithm is leading them to do something over and over and over again?
No, that was not my take on it. My take was that it wasn't the fact that it was some sort of feedback loop and they're doing the same thing over and over again necessarily. It's the fact that you've got all of these packs or mobs of algorithms all doing the same thing, all these different, all these different algorithms out there doing the same thing.
So why would we consider them to be bad, though?
Well, here you go, Jay. I'll tell you exactly why. These scientists think that there's a correlation between the financial market collapse in 2008 and the rise of these algorithms. So if they could make
the
a solid
rise
connection,
of the algorithms.
if they could make that connection solid, that would be something. And I thought that was kind of funny because I thought the Republicans and Democrats caused it. I didn't think it was algorithms.
Well, would you call it an algorithm nation? I would.
Very good. Very good.
It's incredible. And so I think it's clear that we need to be really cautious about this. That seems pretty reasonable. If for no other reason, because these events they're like an unknown phase transition. You know, when they happen, it's like a conventional market theory just boils away. The normal laws do not apply when these events happen. So can we stop it? And I just laugh. I just laugh at that. Good luck. There's really no way in hell that we're going to stop this because this is really it's a billion-dollar techno arms race. You know, developing these and employing these. I mean, who has the fastest, most effective algorithm wins? It's just way too much of an advantage to have these. So here's a great example of this. This one really blew me away a bit. Did you know that they're laying transatlantic cable right now that's being created for the express purpose of gaining 5 milliseconds in trading, between US and the UK traders?
I don't doubt it.
So I think we need to study these algorithms and the pack behavior of these algorithms. And only then can we actually think about employing some regulations to prevent them from taking over the world and completely cutting us out of the loop. There, I said it.
Well,
Bob, are you saying, Bob, that we need to exercise these algorithms from financial trading? Evan, what do you think about that?
Yes. We should call in, I think, a trio of teenagers have them take care of that for us because they are apparently professional exorcists. Oh, wait. I'm referring to some different people here.
Steve, just planned these segues.
I'm 4 for 4 now. 4 for 4.
Wow.
I'd like to point out that I did not initial segue out of politeness.
Yeah, everyone else failed.
Everyone else failed.
All right. Courtesy of all places, the Daily Mail. Now, I think for once, a headline I'm, you know, not specific to the Daily Mail. It just happens to be the Daily Mail. But for once, the editors who came up with this headline got it right. Here we go. Teenage exorcists who say Harry Potter has corrupted the world head to Britain armed with Bibles and holy water to tackle a hotbed of occult activity.
And that, pretty much sums
the article.
Up.
That is technically exactly correct. That is exactly what's happening. And this is not from The Onion. And this is not satire. This was not Saturday Night Live skit.
Could I just say, you know, on behalf of the entire United States, that I want to apologize to the UK for sending these three girls over across the pond.
You give a right.
They sent the Daily Mail article back, so
that's true.
Come on.
So here's the story. I'll read it right from the Daily Mail because they actually do a very good and succinct job of this. They are stunning American teens with black belts in karate, and they spend their weekends battling demons. No, it's not the plot of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. This wholesome trio are actually professional exorcists, and they have come to London with a suitcase full of Bibles and holy water intent on banishing the capital's dark forces. Bryn Larson, who's 18, and the two sisters, Tess and Savannah Schreckenbach, aged 18 and 21, are determined to rescue London's youngsters from evil spirits, which they say are inviting to possess them by reciting the spells in the Harry Potter books.
Yeah, those are real spells.
Yeah. What the one word, like the Avacadavra thing, like that spell?
Yeah.
Avacadavra. Yeah.
Wingardium Leviosa. And all those. Leviosa. And the Patronus spell. Expecto Patronum.
Yep.
I love Patron.
I think these three are going to be giving us a visit soon and try to exorcise some demons from us. They believe that the spells in J.K. Rowling's best-selling fantasy series are real and dangerous. In fact, they see Britain as a hotbed of occult activity whose origins go back to pagan times. Ooh.
It's always the pagans' fault.
As one of them brilliantly explains, it's been centuries in the making, but I believe it came to a pinnacle with the Harry Potter books. They say that the spells you are reading about are not made up. They are real and come from witchcraft. These girls are inspired by their religious faith. They believe loose morals are a prime cause of demonic possession and that promiscuity can transmit sexually transmitted demons in the same way as physical infections. So perhaps our resident doctor would care to comment on that.
Yeah, perhaps.
Have you ever heard of a sexually transmitted demon?
I feel like that's more in my wheelhouse.
So are they saying, Evan, that there's demons in the semen?
Oh, God.
But Evan, usually sex motivates invocations to God, right?
Sure.
No one, nothing?
Nope.
Oh, God?
No.
Never mind.
Nope.
No God.
You got it.
Nope. I give up.
Just reference a George Burns movie? Is that what just happened?
Oh, my God.
I don't know Steve. What that was.
So what are they actually doing, Ev? What physically? Are they walking around? Are they going and having conventions? What's happening?
Brandishing
Yeah, they
causes?
Are actually doing that. They travel, apparently, the world. They were in the Ukraine recently, and traveling with Bryn's father, who is the Reverend Bob Larson. He's kind of, I don't know if he's the ringmaster behind all of this. Reverend Bob says he's guided by God and has cast out more than 15,000 demons in his career. And you can attend, church services and meetings with these girls, and they will, in fact, cast out your demons in mass rituals of exorcism. With a suggested contribution of £200 for a private session, if you'd like a private session with it. And guess what? This is being turned into a documentary. British filmmaker Dan Murdoch has spent 6 months getting to know the trio for an upcoming documentary, which will be shown soon on BBC Three.
One interesting thing, Dan Murdoch spent 6 months making this documentary with these girls. And after that, his quote is that, "I don't believe in exorcisms after doing the documentary, but I do believe in the power of belief after
Ooh,
what I've seen."
Nice.
So.
Okay.
Yeah. Nice. So 6 months of filming exorcisms has not led him to believe in exorcisms, which I fully believe, having seen many a recorded exorcism myself. I've reviewed dozens of taped exorcisms. They are lame.
Yeah.
Nothing happens.
They're like cringe
They are so
inducing.
Boring. Yeah, it's terrible. It's bad role playing.
Yeah.
Horribly bad role playing.
Not even
and
good.
And nothing happens. They're boring as spit.
So watch out
watch out for sexually transmitted demons.
Yeah, that's the takeaway from this, Jay.
Yep. Yep. You can protect yourself by buying a condom. Well, wait a minute. What does the church think about condoms? Ah, well, I guess that's another.
Evan, can you protect yourself with homeopathic vaccines?
We should ask Jay that.
Jay, what do you think?
I would say no. I would say absolutely not. Watch out. And especially if you live in Canada, because the Public Health Agency of Canada has issued a notice stating that there is, in fact, an increase in the incidence of measles across the country. 30 cases had already been reported this year, and that's 5 times as many as last year. So the most likely reason this is happening is that the Public Health Agency of Canada is now allowing, or they have been for a while, allowing a product called Nosodes, a homeopathic vaccine, to its running list of approved products. So have any of you guys ever heard of Nosodes? I don't even know if I'm pronouncing it right.
Nosodes.
Nosodes.
Nosodes are just, it's not a product. It is just, it's a concept, a homeopathic concept. It's a, how they think their homeopathic vaccines work.
I had never heard of them before. I never heard of that classification or whatever. It did sound like, the way that I was reading it, it sounded like a product, but I could see what you mean. Maybe it's just a classification of products. But, Nosodes are homeopathic preparations, and that means they use a small amount of the thing that causes what you're trying to get rid of. So as an example, let's say you have a homeopathic remedy to help cure sleeplessness. So you'd use a small amount of caffeine. Homeopaths believe that the smaller the dose of an active ingredient like caffeine you get, so the smaller dose you get, the more of the opposite effect that it has on you. So, using that logic, Nosodes are made from bodily tissues and fluids. Whoa! These include feces, blood, pus, discharges, and saliva.
Pus,
and these
too?
Things have been, yeah, and they've been taken from suffering patients that are people from suffering from diseases like measles, anthrax, tuberculosis, and the list goes on. So the use of homeopathic remedies to prevent infectious diseases is called homeoprophylaxis. Has anybody ever heard of that term before? I'm sure you have, Steve.
Yeah.
I've heard of it.
Homeoprophylaxis.
Prophylaxis.
That's a great word.
It protects you from those sexually transmitted demons.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yep.
So homeoprophylaxis programs are popping up and more people are using these Nosodes or Nosodes, whatever, to replace the effective vaccinations. CAM supporters are claiming that Nosodes are providing immunity for measles, polio, pertussis, mumps, chickenpox, and other serious childhood illnesses. And of course, it's all complete crap. The only thing that proponents of homeoprophylaxis have is a reference to a 5 to 6 week study on the effectiveness of these types of homeopathic remedies. However, this was not a double-blinded, randomized, or controlled trial, and most were published before 1970 and never replicated. So the efficacy of that stuff is complete garbage. And in Canada, the homeopathic remedies have to get a market authorization from the Natural Health Products Directorate, the NHPD, at Health Canada. The NHPD has currently licensed 82 of these Nosode products. And like I said, these are used to treat the big diseases that I listed before. Strangely, the lack of effectiveness of these products is so well known that the British Homeopathic Association stated there is no evidence to suggest homeopathic vaccinations can protect against contagious diseases. We recommend people seek out the conventional treatments. Hello.
They're just covering themselves there.
But even
that's
still,
just a CYA situation. But yeah, I mean, scientists who have looked at the actual data, and also it's completely implausible. So you have a treatment that is unscientific, would actually violate basic laws of science, like all of homeopathy. And there's no evidence to show that any of these things work. So the recent editorial that you're partly reading from, Jay, by Kunzler and Kaplan, point out that Health Canada licenses these Nosodes, but at the same time says that they require evidence for efficacy for licensure, but then they also don't recommend them for use. So they completely contradict themselves. They should not be licensed in the first place is the bottom line.
Yeah, and they're listing them on the website is them being, in a way, saying these are okay to use.
Yeah, no, they're licensing them. Yep. They are saying they are okay to use.
And I think what we're seeing here is a typical stance that many governments have where they want to quote unquote respect the individual's rights to choose, but they lose sight of the fact that some things are just so stupid that they have to take a stance against them.
Yeah, but it's worse than that. It's worse than just letting people do what they want. it because by licensing it, they're endorsing it. They're saying we've looked at the data and it's safe and effective when it in fact is not true. That's malfeasance. That is betraying the trust of the public that they are supposed to serve. It is a dereliction of their basic duty, a failure that they should either they should be embarrassed about and they should take immediate steps to correct.
Yep. Hey, Bob.
Yes, Evan.
Bob, I'd really love to hear a quickie this week.
Yeah, don't you mean you want a quickie with Bob?
I think I chose my words rather artfully.
Sure. Okay, great. So disappointed.
Okay.
So this
I want a quickie with Bob. How's that?
Ooh, oh boy, you're going to love it.
Oh boy.
Okay, so this is your quickie with Bob. So we got an update on Mars One mission we talked about a while ago. 200,000 people from 140 different countries have officially applied to be the first colonists on Mars. This is the Mars One mission, which is the plan to have a permanent settlement on Mars by 2023. And 200,000, wow. And this was supposed to be a one-way trip, wasn't it? I mean,
oh, yeah.
Once you're there, that's it. So almost 250,000 people. The next thing that's going to happen, the Mars One Selection Committee will choose the candidates from this huge applicant pool. And I don't know how many they'll, you know, how far they're going to winnow that down, but I'm sure they're not going to be, having, 100,000 or 50,000 people to deal with.
Hey, so American Idol does it every season.
Well, I mean, I'm talking about, the people that they're going to select in round one. I'm not sure what that number is going to be, but it'll be a manageable size. Then step two will be to interview each and every person. The Mars One committee members will be doing the interview process. And then if you make it past that phase, you'll go to phase three. And that's the competition between the candidates that's going to be shown on TV and the internet. And also what they're doing is that each region is going to be represented by 20 to 40 of these applicants. And I guess if you live within that region, you'll be able to vote. So, you know, you'll be able to actually help pick one of these applicants, and then the Mars One committee will pick the rest. So that's kind of interesting. And then the final, if you can make it past that round, then it'll be the final round, and that's going to be the international competition, where according to Mars One, the groups will be expected to demonstrate their ability to live in harsh living conditions and work together under difficult circumstances. They're actually going to build a fake Mars habitat and do all sorts of crazy stuff and just to see how well you.
They're
going to
have them produce a podcast together.
So, if anybody, I bet you there's some people in our audience that have actually done this. If you have, then you'll know by the end of 2013 if you make it to the next round. So, good luck, everybody.
Yeah, yeah. If anyone listening to the show is one of those 200,000 people, let us know so we can root for you.
Yeah. And this has been your Quickie with Bob. I hope it was good for you, too.
We need to have a campaign to put the first skeptic on Mars. All right. Well, thank you, Bob. Evan. You know what time it is.
It is that time. Who's that noisy? Each week I play a segment or we solve a puzzle or we do something fun along those lines. And it's up to the audience to guess exactly what the answer is or who made the noise or what made that noisy or who's that noisy. So without further ado, I'm going to play for you last week's Who's That Noisy and then we'll talk about it. So here we go.
The real issue here as far as man is concerned is that when you accept such an important issue as the creation of the universe, on face, you're destroying your confidence and the validity of your own mind.
That was the incomparable and the controversial Ayn Rand, novelist and amateur philosopher from the 20th century, who founded the Objectionist movement and Objectivism.
Objectivist.
Yeah. Yep. So it has some central tenets to it, that reality exists independent of consciousness, that human beings have direct contact with reality through sense perception, and that one can attain objective knowledge from perception through the process of concept formation and inductive logic. Plus, there are certain aspects of moral purposes and individual pursuits and so forth. But that pretty much sums up objectivism, which to me...
Two massive problems.
Yeah, it seems quite incomplete to me.
It's more than incomplete. First of all, we don't have direct access to reality through our senses. We have indirect access to reality through our senses. Our senses construct a model of reality with lots of inference and filtering and confabulation. It's not a direct access to reality. And second, the whole notion of being able to just logic your way to firm conclusions about the nature of the universe was discarded about 2,000 years ago.
Is that?
You need empirical evidence.
Yes, empirical evidence.
But if you're a high school freshman, the shit's going to blow your mind.
It did for me. It absolutely did. I was 14 when I read my first Ayn Rand book. And it did, although I didn't think about it in the strictly philosophical sense. There was a more practical influence, I think, it had for me. And I think it was kind of the first time I realized that other people out there really don't have the same ideas of individualism. Never got into this objectivism at all with Ayn. And she's a lot of her, detractors and people who talk against her philosophy and stuff feel that she started somewhat of a cult in her, approach, and certainly how her groups organized around these books. Lots of correct guesses.
Well, who won this week?
Yes, so this week's winner, Brandy Jeffries, was one of the many correct guessers. So Brandy, congratulations. Your name goes into the final drawing at the end of the year. If we draw your name, you're going to join us for a segment of Science or Fiction early in 2014. Congratulations.
And what do you got for this week?
So for this week, we haven't done this in a long time, so I felt it was time to do it again. We're going to ask the audience to send us some of some clips or suggestions about a particular phrase or sentence that they feel is the best skeptical phrase that they've ever heard in a movie. It can be any movie you want. Go ahead and send us your favorite sentence and or phrase, and WTN@theskepticsguide.org is the email address to send those to, or if you would rather post them onto our forums, sguforums.com, and we look forward to reading what you can come up with.
So basically, you couldn't find anything for this week is what you're saying.
I am not saying that at all, actually.
Okay, good cover.
Remember a couple of weeks ago, we asked people to write a very concise statement, like the bumper sticker.
I don't like anything that we were said.
Well, they had as hard a time as we did.
Keep brainstorming on that. So we wanted people to come up with the best bumper sticker pithy phrase that conveys the idea that it's okay to respect the consensus, the authority of a legitimate consensus, but not to make an argument from authority.
You just shrink what you just said down to like size 7.
Yeah, so capture that in a pithy phrase. Most people said some variation of, respect authority, but don't worship it. Respect authority, but look at the evidence. It's like, okay, it's sort of okay, but I don't think they really took it to the next level where they really captured something. So I think we should keep that one open. So keep brainstorming and sending us your suggestions. We are reading them all. All right, let's move on to a couple of emails. The first one comes from Sam Johnson, who writes, "Hey guys, I recently attended a lecture given by a researcher from Newcastle University upon the topic of Bedelovibrio bacteria. This is a bacterium which invades other bacterial cells, including pathogens harmful to humans, such as E. coli. I found this extremely interesting. It seems it could be a major replacement to our ever more ineffective antibiotics. I would like to hear the host, Dr. Stephen Novella, and the rest of the panel's opinion on it. I apologize if this has already been covered by the podcast. Thank you very much for your time. I'm a big fan and love the work that you do. Keep it up. Yours faithfully, Sam." All right. Thank you, Sam. We have not covered this topic before. Bob, have you ever heard of Bedelovibrio?
No, I have not.
Okay. So, how about the rest of you? I have any Bedelovibrio?
Bordello, what now? No.
This is my favorite song.
It's a bacteria, a small bacteria. It's classified as a gram negative bacteria, which just describes how it stains. And this bacteria evolved to infect and prey upon other bacteria, other larger gram negative bacteria. It eats them, reproduces, and then spreads.
Poops them out.
Yeah, to infect more bacteria, kind of like what a virus does. The idea is that since this bacteria will infect other bacteria, maybe it will be benign to eukaryotic cells. That's what we're made of. And therefore you could infect people who are infected with the bacteria, with the Bordetella vibrio, and that it will attack and kill the pathogenic bacteria, leaving the host alone. So these bacteria were discovered in the 1960s, so we've known about them for quite some time. There essentially are no clinical studies showing that they are safe and effective for the treatment of any specific type of infection in humans. So they are not yet at the point where we could say that they are an effective treatment for anything. But the basic science does look very promising. What the basic science shows is that certain species of Bordetella vibrio will infect and kill pathogenic bacteria, bacteria that cause disease in humans. And in vitro studies have shown that they are benign to eukaryotic cells. They don't seem to infect our own cells, cells that people are made out of. So those are two interesting components. You know, that if you add those two things together, it certainly makes it an interesting possible therapeutic option, especially for bacteria that are resistant to multiple antibiotics. But we need to know how these bacteria are going to behave in a human host in the quote-unquote wild, right? So that's what we don't know. That's the last bit. And there's lots of variables, lots of reasons why it may not work out. They may not maintain their pathogenicity against the other bacteria throughout an infection. They may not be virulent enough. You know, they may, in fact, infect and attack the other bacteria, but not fast enough, not faster than the other bacteria is infecting, you know, the person. Yeah. So we just don't know. You know, it's interesting. It's, and also, you know, if you start in the petri dish, it seems safe, but if, you know, we don't know what the potential is for these bacteria to mutate and pick up the ability, maybe they'll pick up the features from the pathogenic bacteria and start causing a human infection. Hopefully that's not likely, but until we do it, we just don't know. So, interesting concept, using bacteria to fight other bacteria.
I like it.
Yeah, it's there's basically using them as little targeted bacterial killing machines. But we need to do the clinical research to know what the net effect is. Right now we're still in the basic science phase of this. Not sure why this has taken 50 years, you know, to get to this point. But that usually when that happens, what I suspect is that over the years, people have looked at it and it hasn't really panned out. And so it just gets filed away somewhere and it never really takes off. I'm not sure why there wouldn't have been more studies on the thing 30 or 40 years ago. But we'll see. It looks like researchers are taking another look at these bacteria. We'll see. So far, the basic science is looking promising and the concept is fine.
It's time for science or fiction.
Well, we're being joined now by Richard Saunders. Richard, welcome back to the Skeptic's Guide. Always a pleasure.
Hello, Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Hello,
Richard.
Hello.
I know that voice, evil Captain J.
I'll catch you, Captain Saunders.
Never.
Every time, guys, you got to do that, really?
Yes, yeah. Bob. From now on, that's it, right? That's your thing?
I dream about doing that.
What's that? You dreaming about me? What?
Richard, I hear somebody just told me that you were reelected to be president of the Australian Skeptics.
Yeah, we had our meeting just a couple of days ago, as we do every year, and all the positions came up vacant, as they do by the Constitution and our committee. And yes, I was reelected the president of Australian Skeptics for another year, and Dr. Rachie Dunlop was reelected vice president of the Skeptics for another year, which is good news.
Awesome.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Well
done. I'm not surprised. Richard, we'll give you the SGU seal of approval right now.
Oh, thank you.
It's not an actual seal.
It's not an actual seal, right?
It's actually a hummingbird, but it's a hummingbird of approval.
Okay.
Exactly.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
So, Richard, we're really bringing you on this week because you want to plug some conference or something that down there on the other side of the world?
On the other side of the world, I'd like to just remind your listeners and listeners to the Skeptic Zone and people in Australia generally, that we have our annual convention. The Australian Skeptics Annual Convention is in Canberra this year, the capital of the nation. And this is a capital, an Australian capital, where you really can see kangaroos jumping down the street. I kid you not. Mm-hmm. This is not a joke. This is not some silly joke for tourists. Last time I was there, I was giving a talk down there, and they were kindly driving me around, and a kangaroo jumped by the car. This is, it all happens there. But this year, the convention, that's true. It's all about conspiracy theories. Maybe mm-hmm. that's cool. a conspiracy theory. Because the convention is on the 22nd of November, 22nd to the 24th, and it coincides with the 50th anniversary of the assassination of JFK.
Yes.
Ah, interesting. And you're telling us about that on the 12th anniversary of 9/11.
I am indeed. How about that?
I smell a conspiracy.
Yeah, what are the
odds? There's something going on here. What are the odds of that? it's also the 50th anniversary of Doctor Who.
Yes, I'm well aware of that.
And
in
so
November.
As a salute to Doctor Who and the influence Doctor Who's had on society and many skeptics, I must say, including myself, the convention dinner is a Doctor Who theme. So you can come as your favorite Doctor Who character.
Mm-hmm.
How about that?
But, oh, God, but I wish I could go.
You won't get to see the 12th Doctor first.
When's that? That's on the 26th or something, isn't it, of November or the 20th?
Well, I think you're not going to get to see the 12th Doctor till the Christmas special.
Oh, okay. Oh, interesting.
In November, the new season starts, but I think that's just going to be like Matt Smith's last episode.
That's right. That's right. I'll have to try and sneak away and watch that if I can. But conspiracy theories, and we're flying out from the UK. Our special guest is Dr. Chris French.
He's awesome.
He's great. Mm-hmm. Yes, I've met Dr. Chris French in QED at the QED conference in Manchester. So he's going to be our feature speaker. I'll be speaking. Dr. Rachel will be speaking, Aran Sergeyev, and many, many other great speakers. So the best way for listeners to find out more and book your tickets quick, because there aren't many left now. It's a bit late, but there still are some tickets. So go to nationalskepticsconvention.org and you can get your tickets.
Yeah, one of these days, Richard, we'll have to get back down there for another SGU conference.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I've been thinking about that, Steve. It's not such a bad idea. I think Australia is... had a long enough gap now between the visit of the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. We've recovered.
You've recovered.
We've recovered. It was November 2010. It's been a while. I think you guys might be starting to think of another trip down there.
Yeah, we might have to start the wheels moving in that direction.
Sounds good to me.
Well, hey, Richard, while we got you, you want to hang around for Science or Fiction?
All right.
I got to warn you, though. I'm coming off of 2 weeks in a row where I have completely stumped the panel.
Oh.
Yeah, but I wasn't here the previous week, so I don't think it really counts.
Sure it does. Okay, so...
we guessed for you, Rebecca. You got it wrong.
No.
That's true. All right, so here we go. Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 genuine and 1 fictitious. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. And yet again, we have a theme this week.
Although,
this does involve actual news items this time. 3 news items, but there is a theme. These are all items from the Journal of Consumer Research. So these are all news items involving consumer research, the psychology of buying stuff. Is everyone ready?
Okay, yes, right. Let's do it. Good luck, everyone. We can't let Steve win this week, guys.
Okay. Here we go. Item number 1. New research finds that hearing a salesperson flatter another customer causes a negative reaction to the salesperson, but increases the desire to buy an expensive item. Item number 2, a new study finds that subjects were more likely to purchase a lottery ticket if they had just spent money on an expensive, high-status item. And item number 3, researchers find that women are more likely to purchase expensive accessories when they feel threatened in their relationship, and that this strategy works because women are also less likely to pursue a man whose girlfriend has expensive accessories.
Ooh.
Well, I didn't even get that.
What?
What? Who?
Yeah, I didn't get that either.
I got it with my handbag.
All right. Well, Richard, you're going to lead the way, so you start for us.
Lead the way. That's very optimistic of you. All right.
Lead astray, whatever.
Lead astray. New research finds that hearing a salesperson flatter another customer causes a negative reaction to the salesperson but increases the desire to buy an expensive item. That is so convoluted, it's almost like that was made up. I'm just going to think about that for a minute, but I'm interested in this next one. The new study finds that subjects are more likely to purchase a lottery ticket if they've just spent money on an expensive high-status item. You know what? I think I'm tempted to put that one as fake. I'm just thinking about the psychology of it. And the third one, researchers find women are most likely to purchase expensive accessories when they feel threatened in their... That's very complicated, too. My feeling is that this number two is the fake. I'm going to go with number two with the lottery ticket. I just got a feeling that if you spend a lot of money buying something, you're probably going to be satisfied and walk away rather than lashing out extra on a lottery ticket. That's my thinking. I'll see how I go. Okay, number two.
Okay, Jay.
The first one about the salesperson who flatters a customer. The effect that you're saying is that that another person that's in the store that hears that flattery.
Yeah.
But they said that causes an increase on that person's part to buy an expensive item.
That's correct.
I mean, I get that these things are that complicated because human behavior is phenomenally complicated. Sure. All right. The second one about the study that finds subjects were more likely to buy a lottery ticket after they just bought a really expensive thing. I could kind of see that. You know, let's say you go out and you buy a really expensive car. And then a week later, you have kind of like buyer's remorse where you're like, oh man, I can't afford that. Maybe I'll play the lottery. I'll spend a dollar, play the lottery and see if I can get my money back. All right. That's stupid enough to believe that people would do that unconsciously. Sure. And then the last one, a woman looking for a man that sees another woman with a lot of bling is not going to go after her man because of the bling. That's weird. Very strange. But that, you know, this is complicated because women are very complicated.
It's true. We're like aliens. Mm.
It's like they're from Venus or something.
I think the first one about the flattery is false because I can't see how a bad salesman, you know, flattering a customer is going to make another customer want to spend more money in the store than they probably normally would have. That just doesn't make any sense. I think that's the fake.
Okay, Bob.
I disagree, Jay. The first one I could kind of make a little bit sense out of it because, all right, you hear a salesperson flatter another customer and this supposedly causes a negative reaction. Because, yeah, my first reaction would be something like, oh, you know, he's just totally playing this person. He's just working it, trying to work the sale. But then I could also see subconsciously the person, you know, wanting that positive reinforcement directed at them as well, so maybe they're a little bit more inclined to buy something a little bit more expensive than they would have because of that. I mean, I don't know if I'm totally rationalizing this, but I can have this make sense as well because, you know, you buy a high status item, you really like it because when you get like a new car or something really nice, you know, of course, it's a fantastic feeling, and I could see you thinking, man, if I just won the lotto or the lottery, I could buy stuff like this all the time. So I can kind of make sense of that one as well. The third one though, I'm a little confused about here, Steve. All right. So you say that the women are more likely to purchase expensive accessories when they feel threatened. Now, my first assumption was that somehow she uses her boyfriend's money, but I guess what you mean is that she just buys it not necessarily with his money, but probably with her money, right? I mean, that was the intention.
I think it's pretty self-explanatory.
But then it doesn't make sense. Yeah, I don't know why other women would be less likely to pursue her guy because she has expensive accessories. Oh, wait, maybe. Oh, so maybe.
Whoa!
Maybe. Whoa, what?
I'm just messing with you.
Take your time, Bob.
So,
take your time.
Take all the time you need. Give me an answer right away.
So maybe if she, wait, but maybe if she were more well off, yeah, if she were more, let me just finish this line of reasoning. If she were more well off, if she's like makes money, then he would be happier and less inclined to break up with her. So that's how, oh shit, I can make sense of all of these. Damn.
Steve, I want to change my answer. No, it's all right.
Too late.
Bob, you've been in all these situations, right?
I'll go with the lottery's fiction.
The lottery's fiction. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, Rebecca.
Yeah, my thinking was similar to Bob's with the salesperson one. I think that the negative reaction to the salesperson could easily be something like jealousy, you know, and so then they act out in order to, get the same sort of positive flattery. Buying a lottery ticket right after you spend money on a high status item, that's the one that seems the most like the fiction to me. Like Bob's reasoning, that does not make any sense at all to me. I've bought expensive things before, and never have I thought like, oh, I should go buy a lottery ticket. The last one about expensive accessories is just the most ridiculous, stupid thing I've ever heard in my life.
And you've heard some pretty ridiculous, stupid things.
Yeah, I have.
Rebecca,
I knew you would love that one.
And I am 100% sure that it is wrong, that is complete and utter BS. However,
but
I am also sure somebody did a study about this and they came to that BS conclusion. And yeah, I think Bob was on to something at the end. I think that their BS explanation was that, women, you know, buy these expensive accessories and it shows that they have status because something, something, hunters gathers, blah, 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 did the study on 10 upper class white college freshmen, therefore science. So in conclusion, I'm saying that technically, for the purposes of this game, the lottery ticket one is the fiction.
And Evan.
I will say the lottery ticket one is fiction. My thinking behind it is that lottery tickets are primarily purchased by people who cannot afford high status items typically to begin with.
Okay. So that means you all agree that researchers find that women are more likely to purchase expensive accessories when they feel threatened in their relationship, and that this strategy works because women are also less likely to pursue a man whose girlfriend has expensive accessories. You all think that one is completely solid, rock solid science without any problems whatsoever. And that one is science.
Yeah.
All right.
I knew you'd have fun with that one, Rebecca. yeah. I'm not vouching for the quality of these items. These are just all items from the Journal of Consumer Research. But this is interesting. You know, obviously there's a lot of assumptions here. There's just anything about, you know, why the women are behaving this way in the study. It could certainly be culture or the implicit assumptions of the study or whatever. But this is what they showed. There's a series of studies in which they invited women to imagine something benign versus imagine their boyfriend flirting with another girl. And in the group that imagined the, you know, threatening situation to the relationship, they exhibited more a desire to buy expensive purses or expensive accessories. They, you know, did several different measures of their desire for expensive or high status items, like drawing logos, and they would draw them twice as big as that.
What?
Really?
You know how psychological studies are. So then,
yeah, you know,
yeah, that's
oh yeah, science.
Yeah,
oh that.
They also in other studies showed that women who were wearing luxury outfits or high or expensive accessories were judged to be that the assumption is on the part of the subjects was one that if a woman has expensive accessories that her boyfriend bought them for her. And that therefore that shows that they are devoted. So it was a measure of devotion. Mm. And they were therefore less likely to pursue a man who already is showing signs of being devoted to somebody else, I guess, because that's a less likely prospect.
I wish you could
prospect.
See the bitch please look on my face
right now. I figured.
Oh, I can feel it.
That's what they found. Interpretation is another thing. Okay. So, Jay, you're all alone with number one here. New research finds that hearing salesperson flatter another customer causes a negative reaction to the salesperson but increases the desire to buy an expensive item. Jay, you think this one is the fiction. The rest of you think this one is science. And this one is science. Sorry, Jay. In this study, you know, they basically had customers overhear a salesperson profusely compliment a third person, another customer. And they measured a few things. One was whether or not the salesperson seemed sincere. And the key variable there seemed to be whether or not they were flattering the customer before or after the purchase. Before the purchase, the assumption was that the flattery was insincere, but after the purchase, the assumption was that the flattery was sincere. Interestingly, that didn't seem to matter very much. Either way, the initial reaction to the flattery was to have a negative opinion of the salesperson themselves. However, upon further thought, the subjects did, as this is exactly what you said, Bob. Initially, like, oh, that's kind of creepy, you know, the way he's overly flattering that other person. But then that led to envy, jealousy of the, whatever the person bought to get the flattery of the salesperson. And people in that situation spent more money on more high priced items than the control group. They were more likely to buy expensive items, I guess, to, deal with their feelings of envy.
Hmm. That's weird.
Yeah. All of this means that a new study finds that subjects were more likely to purchase a lottery ticket if they had just spent money on an expensive high status item. That one is the fiction.
Of course.
So the real item is that people, a study which shows that people who just purchased a lottery ticket exhibit less self-control. They are more likely to prefer a small immediate reward to a deferred, more expensive or valuable reward. So it's kind of like, you guys remember the marshmallow test? You know?
Yes.
Yum.
The self-control, the ability to defer immediate gratification.
That's for children, isn't it?
Yeah, but it could be, doesn't have to be for children. Yeah. I don't think they literally did the marshmallow test in this study, but that's the same. It's the same basic concept. So I just sort of reversed it, you know, and to make the fiction, but I also had to make sure that this wasn't inadvertently true. So I did do some, I did look up some studies on like why people buy lottery tickets to see if anything like this would come up. And it seems that, the primary consistent signal in terms of when people are more motivated to buy lottery tickets is when they are poor. So feeling poor motivates people to buy lottery tickets. One study they did. Yeah. So that's why it's, you know, it's one of the main criticisms of states using lotteries in order to fund education or whatever is that it's a tax on the poor because poor people disproportionately buy lottery tickets. It's also a tax on the uneducated because uneducated people also are more likely to buy lottery tickets.
Hey.
So
well, poor people are more likely.
The winning
to be
numbers
uneducated,
are as follows.
So.
Yeah.
4, 12, 18. Pi. E.
That sounds like an idiot's luggage.
So they did an interesting study in which they like had people they were just taking a survey. They didn't know obviously what the point of the study was, what they were being studied for. But they in the process of filling out a survey, people filled in their income, and they different groups were given different ranges. So like in one group, one of the income categories was less than $100,000 a year. And that was the lowest end and then went up from there. So most people taking the survey would have been in the lowest income group and that would make them feel relatively poor. Whereas in the other group, the lowest category was less than $10,000 a year and then went up in $10,000 increments. So the average person would be somewhere in the middle. So the people answering that latter survey felt that their relative wealth was somewhere in the average, you know, in the middle of the range that was being offered. Whereas in the first one, they were in the lowest or the poorest category. And then they were given $5 to take a survey. And then they had the opportunity immediately after that to buy lottery tickets. And the people who felt, you know, more poor, made to feel more poor, bought significantly more lottery tickets than people who weren't made to feel poor. So buying a high status item probably would have the opposite effect.
This, I can't help thinking, Steve, of the situation where we have a major skeptical convention every year with hundreds and hundreds of skeptical, rational people going to a casino.
Yeah. Although we don't gamble much when we're there.
Exactly.
As a group.
Exactly.
As a group. Yeah. Yeah.
That's the point. Yeah. I think all the years I've been going to Vegas.
I do too, Bob.
I think I've spent a grand total of $10 on the tables, so.
Yeah, I mean, if you do it for fun or socializing or whatever, but, rational thinking is pretty incompatible with a lot of motivation for gambling. Casinos want people to believe in luck to be irrational because that motivates higher levels of gambling. Jay, hit us with a quote.
I got the quote. Okay, so this week's quote was sent in by a listener named Stephen Richards from London, England. And Stephen was watching some old episodes of Cosmos. And this was an episode where Carl was talking about Kepler. And the quote was, "When he found that his long cherished beliefs did not agree with the most precious observations, he accepted the uncomfortable facts. He preferred the hard truth to his dearest delusions. That is the heart of science."
Carl Sagan!
Yeah.
I like that you and Carl Sagan are on first name basis.
Yeah.
Carl.
Carl, sure.
But everybody knows when you say Carl, like who am I talking about?
That's how Chapter 3 ends of the Cosmos series.
Steve, real quick, I'd like to make an announcement. SGUtranscripts.org. We have a core group of admins that are still plugging away trying to transcribe all of the SGU episodes, and we're going to run another competition. Anybody that goes to SGUtranscripts.org and signs up to become a new transcriber, we will track your progress over the next month, and whoever does the most transcriptions will win some SGU swag.
Ooh. All right. Well, everyone, thank you for joining me this week. Thank you for joining us, Richard.
Thank you. Thank you,
everybody. And two URLs before I go. Your listeners will do well to visit curiosityshow.com.au, and when you're there, you'll know why. And the Skeptics in Australia is skeptics.com.au.
All right, Richard, say hi to everyone for us down under.
I sure will, and look forward to hearing Evan Bernstein on the Skeptic Zone coming up.
Ah.
Oh, awesome. I can't wait.
Hey, and thanks for joining me, guys.
Yep, thank you, Steve.
Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.